our green infrastructure webinar. So I'm going to turn things over to Michelle Mahoney and Melissa Friedland. Ladies, whenever you're ready to begin.
Good afternoon. My name is Melissa Friedland, and I'm EPA's Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment. I want to thank you all for joining us today. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI, hosts these webinars as part of a quarterly series about the reuse of Superfund sites. Our webinars share the stories of sites and projects that are part of SRI, and they also provide guidance and tools to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. On today's webinar, we're going to cover the topic of green infrastructure elements in the context of reuse and revitalization of contaminated lands. I'm going to start the presentation with a very brief introduction to reuse and EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, which plays a key role in supporting reuse as a priority at EPA. I'm going to turn things over to Michelle Mahoney, who's going to give us an in-depth look at green infrastructure and how it can support sustainability. Michelle is also going to provide some insight into strategies for considering and implementing green infrastructure and the types of resources that are available for doing so. After that, we'll hear from Carlos Fichon, who will provide some insight on the connection between green remediation and green infrastructure. We'll then hear from Tom Bloom, Jay Steffen, Douglas Reed Green, and Rosemary Caraway, who will share their experiences at three sites where green infrastructure strategies have been implemented. These three sites will each touch on different aspects of planning, funding, and implementing green infrastructure. So I'd like to take a few minutes just to share about reuse and the way that SRI can support site reuse, and make the point again that EPA's primary mission is to protect human health and the environment, and returning contaminated sites to productive use can contribute to these goals. So SRI works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. EPA has always been supportive of site reuse, but in recent years, reuse has become an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals, and it's very important to note that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. There are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate. Additionally, many sites can support multiple types of reuse. For example, a single site could host recreational reuse, including playground equipment and sports fields, and then also support ecological reuse as a wetlands environmental education area. I want to encourage you to visit the SRI website to find more examples like this, as well as in-depth information about Superfund site reuse. And if you have any questions about reuse or SRI, please do not hesitate to contact me. And I want to encourage you to send in questions for our presenters. We'll try and answer questions after each section, but we may hold some questions if we think future presenters will address them. There'll also be time at the end of the presentations for remaining questions. So first up is Michelle Mahoney from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. Take it away.
Jean, can you pull up my slides? Thank you very much, Melissa. As Melissa mentioned, my name is Michelle Mahoney, and I work with EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about green infrastructure and how it can be incorporated into Superfund reuse planning. I wanted to just start out with a definition of green infrastructure. In general, it's a framework for understanding the valuable services that nature provides for the human environment and integrating these natural assets into planning and development. Typically, communities will set aside space for commercial or industrial development, but sometimes space for parks, recreational areas, and conservation may be limited. And in these cases, Superfund sites can present a rare opportunity to open up a large area of land that has been strategically located in a community, and it could be considered for some of these green infrastructure elements. There's lots of benefits to incorporating green infrastructure into Superfund site reuse, and listed here on the slide, I'll read a couple of them. Again, green infrastructure can help EPA meet a range of our program goals, including promoting sustainable communities, environmental justice, and clean urban waters. It's a viable reuse option for the site. Can be also be used as an interim use for this, for part of the site during the long-term cleanup. It can be a way for managing drainage from caps at Superfund sites. Can bring together partners and different funding sources for the reuse of the site. There's lots of educational opportunities for schools and the residents. And it can revitalize the community with a sustainable reinvestment to offset the site stigma that has been there with the Superfund site. So the Superfund reuse planning projects across the country, we see a common set of green infrastructure goals that can be considered in the reuse planning process. You'll see these listed on this slide, revitalize the site ecology, improve stormwater, and increase recreational amenities. One or more of these goals might be the main focus of the reuse plan, or there could be smaller green infrastructure elements integrated into the reuse plans, focusing on economic opportunities and other community amenities. With each of these goals, there's a common set of strategies. And I also want to mention that these goals aren't mutually exclusive of each other, and often a reuse plan will include multiple goals and strategies. So I'm going to just go over each of these goals and their related strategies, and then you'll hear from my co-presenters who will provide more in-depth look at how specific sites have related to these goals. So the first goal of revitalizing the site ecology, ecological revitalization strategies create optimal living conditions for aquatic and terrestrial species. Revitalizing natural areas to create or improve wildlife habitats can occur on portions of the site as it's being reused. There might be other parts of the site that have different types of uses. We can provide community residents with the opportunity to enjoy bike paths, walking paths, native woodlands, wildlife viewing areas, and just areas of natural beauty. And some of these strategies that can be used to revitalize the site ecology include habitat restoration, phytoremediation, environmental educational opportunities, and greening economies. Pictured here on the slide, we have the Quincy Smelter as an example. This is one of the most complete remaining 19th century copper smelters in the world, and this smelter is offering opportunities to learn about some of the historic industrial technologies and how the environmental impacts of mining can be addressed, as well as restore the community's connection to the waterfront. And this site is also going to be a future home of a National Park Visitor Center. The next goal is improving stormwater. This primarily means naturally directing and cleaning stormwater and preventing erosion and the need for expensive gray infrastructure elements. Some of the strategies included with improving stormwater are constructed wetlands, natural drainage bioswales, and floodplains. So the economic vitality and the quality of the neighborhood housing of the East Side neighborhood in Freeport, Illinois, where you see photos here, were severely impacted over time by the neighborhood's location to the Pecatonica River floodway. The community looked at different green infrastructure strategies on vacant properties, Superfund sites, brownfield sites, and publicly owned lands to try to overcome the limitations they had with the existing gray infrastructure to try to help reduce the flooding impacts and temporarily and safely store stormwater until it can drain. Another goal is to increase recreational amenities. This can be achieved by creating attractive spaces for recreational activities or social gatherings. These types of amenities can improve the quality of life for communities, raise property values. Some of the strategies can include trails, green streets, program spaces, and green links to urban waters. So the Paradise Creek Industrial Corridor Future Use Plan, which you see pictured on this slide, is a great example of this. It includes strategies such as increasing the multimodal transportation with green complete streets, developing signage and educational programs, promoting recreational creek access, and restoring the community's connection to urban waters. So planning for green infrastructure at Superfund sites can be integrated into the typical reuse assessment and planning process. The graphic that you see here outlines the reuse process, and I'm going to go through and mention a few considerations for the specific green infrastructure and how that can be incorporated into this process. So in step one, we want to look at gathering what the community wants and the community needs are for the site. For example, you could identify a specific habitat or watershed and recreational goals. You can consider reaching out to the local government. Other agencies and nonprofit stakeholders might have some expertise with the local green infrastructure goals and assets. In step two, we want to determine what the site's suitability is. And in doing this, we want to consider identifying natural assets of the site, such as water features and vegetation. Identify long-term revenue components and institutional controls that might prevent structural development but could otherwise be suitable for the green infrastructure elements at this site. In step three, we want to evaluate the land use context. For example, consider whether there's some recreational amenities that may be missing in the community and whether green infrastructure might fit into a larger sustainability approach to the economic development of the area. And in step four, we want to develop some recommendations. Then these can include a reuse plan that focuses on green infrastructure uses such as habitat, watershed, recreational uses. You could also try to include some goals, principles, and strategies related to implementing the green infrastructure as part of the reuse plan. So in today's webinar, we're very fortunate to have three in-depth case study presentations. Each of the sites that you're going to hear about are going to highlight a particular green infrastructure goal as you see here on the screen. I want to emphasize that green infrastructure projects typically employ multiple strategies to address multiple goals, and these strategies can be organically interwoven through a project and are not mutually exclusive of each other. So the sites that we're going to hear about the Butterworth Landfill. We'll have Tom Bloom from EPA and Jay Steffen from the city of Grand Rapids, Michigan, is going to talk about the reuse at that site. We have the Landia Chemical Company. We'll hear from Doug about some of the great work that they're doing there to increase habitat and greenways. And then Pemico Maywood, I believe we have Rosemary is going to be speaking to us about some of the efforts that they've taken to improve stormwater at that site. So with that, I think we'll move on to our next presenter.
It's Tom Bloom.
Oh, Tom Bloom. Okay.
He's going to talk about increasing recreational amenities at Butterworth.
Yeah, it's not Carlos, it's Tom, right, Melissa?
Yes, Tom.
Okay. My name is Tom Bloom. I'm the Region 5 Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator, and I wanted to tell everybody that Region 5 consists of six states: Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. And as you heard from Michelle, green infrastructure strategies often overlap with revitalization and remedy strategies, and I'm here today to talk a little bit about the Butterworth Landfill and how an on-site drainage canal, site wetlands, and paved haul roads all help to promote recreational reuse. Next slide. Thank you, Jean. I think you did that for me. Okay, first of all, I wanted to tell you a little bit about the site. The Butterworth Landfill is a 190-acre landfill that's located west of Grand Rapids, Michigan, and it's right along the Grand River in the 100-year floodplain. The City of Grand Rapids owned and operated the landfill as an open dump from 1950 to 1967, and then the site was operated as a sanitary landfill from 1967 to 1973 when it was closed. During its years of operation, the landfill received municipal solid waste and industrial waste, including plating waste and paint waste and organic solvents. It was a commingled landfill that had hazardous and solid wastes. And of course, in 1982, they identified volatile organic compounds, heavy metals coming out of the landfill in the groundwater. They also identified that some of the soils were contaminated with PCBs and pesticides and pyrene. Next slide, if I can get there. Oh, you got it for me, Gene. Thank you. So in 1983, the EPA added the Butterworth landfill to the national priorities list. And in around 1990, we did a soil and drum removal project out there where we removed PCB-contaminated soils. Shortly after that, in 1992, we selected a remedy for the landfill that had already been covered, but our remedy consisted of upgrading the landfill covered with 2 feet of compressed clay and then 2 feet of cover materials with continued groundwater monitoring. During the design, we discovered that part of the landfill, well, part of the 190 acres wasn't covered. There was a portion in the middle that you'll see later on in the J slides that's called the radio tower and station building area. It's about 30 acres in the middle of the landfill that didn't receive any waste. So we changed the remedy to address the fact that we didn't have to cover 190 acres, that we were going to omit 30 acres from that. And then also there was some change in some groundwater, some surface water interface standards from the state of Michigan. So we changed the cleanup goals there in 1998. Shortly after that, 99, we started constructing the remedy, and the cap has been complete for years now, and we are just continuing to monitor the groundwater out at the site. One of the things that was done kind of neat at the time was, instead of putting number two gravel down on all the haul roads, remember this is a 190-acre landfill, so there's quite a bit of haul roads out there, and then having to dress them up every 2 or 3 years because the gravel would wear away, the remedial project manager at the time decided to spend the money up front and pave the haul roads, and that comes into play later on when we looked at some of the opportunities that the site had to offer for us. I'm going to try to go to the next slide myself. Okay. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about, I'm supposed to talk about site remediation. Oh, no, site drainage. Okay. And the use of natural resources. So given the site's location along the banks of the river and the need for proper drainage for both remedial and reuse purposes, it made sense to use a vegetated stormwater drainage canal that runs north and south through the site. To drain the cap and make sure that the surface water flows in the right directions. In addition, it made sense to use some of the wetlands that were located on site to deal with the runoff from the cap after it was put together there. Those wetlands helped to provide collection zones when we had high storm events, but also served as wildlife habitat areas for viewing and all like that. That's some of the things that we identified when we were looking at the opportunities that the site presented. So by doing proper grading for surface drainage and using this canal that runs through the site and making sure that we had good vegetation for erosion control along the drainage networks, instituting swales and ditches, it ensured that we had positive drainage off the cap, but also promotes the use of the site for redevelopment later on. So I'll go to my next slide. And so I'll talk about some of the initial reuse considerations. Initially, the city came to us in 2006. We did another activity, that's the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative Program, in 2008, and then again in 2003. And when we looked at the opportunities that the site had because of its size and level surface and the prime location and the excitement of the stakeholders in the area there, we knew that it presented a unique opportunities for future uses. We held a couple of community meetings that everybody was very interested at, and the community expressed a lot of interest in all kinds of recreational opportunities, including a golf driving range, an archery range, a boat launch, community gardens, the bike trails that we were talking, the trail system that I was talking about, the haul ropes, a flying field for model airplanes, skate park, BMX racing. Now, once the site was cleaned up, the site was fenced off and restricted, and before we could move forward, we needed assurance that the future use would not harm the remedy, and that the remedy would be compatible with the future recreational uses. So in 2008, we went back and we did some reuse characterization where we looked at the site remedial features. Jay's going to address this a little bit more, looking at the cap and the groundwater wells, where they were sticking up, where they were flush mounted, looking at some of the utilities on the site. There was some water lines brought in there and some electrical lines, not any sewer, looking at site access, looking at the drainage in the stormwater, and then also looking at site ownership and parcel information in this reuse characterization report. And then to me, bring it up further, just recently, we re-engaged and we did a solar reuse assessment where we looked at certain parts of the site that would be suitable as far as slopes are concerned for solar panels, where the substations are, who needs the electricity in the area. And we put that all together into an assessment, and Jay's going to talk a little bit more about that right now. Go ahead, Jay.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Jay Steffen, and I'm the Assistant Planning Director with the City of Grand Rapids. And I'd like to first start out by saying that we have enjoyed a very cooperative relationship with the EPA and appreciate all of their assistance in helping us to come up with reuse ideas, and which will be further discussed in the presentation. The slide that you're seeing here was a risk assessment graphic that was completed in 2003. And as Tom mentioned, those haul roads throughout the 190 acres not only offered the opportunity to provide vehicular access, but also to use those roads as a trail system. And so in 2003, we completed a risk assessment at EPA's request in order to put those roads into use as non-motorized trails. In 2004, the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative provided a regional seed to jumpstart the first of several reuse assessments at the site. That same year, the City of Grand Rapids included the site reuse ideas in its city's master plan. And additionally, the EPA announced that year the start of the Return to Use initiative at that site. This meant that the EPA would work with site stakeholders to address any barriers that might hinder safe and appropriate reuse. During the Return to Reuse initiative, those roads were opened up as trails. The site was opened and the keep out signs were removed from the site. To provide long-term stewardship of the site and to ensure that any future uses maintain protection of human health and environment, the EPA and city continued working with the community to develop a site use framework and conceptual design plan. And what you'll see throughout is that this has been an iterative process where we've had a number of conceptual plans for the site. Those have changed as we've discovered opportunities and constraints of developing the site for various reasons. As Tom mentioned, the tough part of developing the site is to put infrastructure in that would allow for and support recreational uses. Specifically, water and sewer can be challenging and quite expensive. We held public meetings in 2005 to help inform the reuse project, and that spawned a number of ideas for viable recreation amenities. The early reuse goals were open space, trails, a boat launch with longer-term transition to sports fields, a model aeronautics, a skateboard park, and dog park. Reuse discussions became more refined as future site users were surveyed. In 2006, we did some additional conceptual plans that included two options, one with trails, boating access, and interpretive exhibits along the riparian area near the Grand River, and a second planned concept that had non-motorized trails, a BMX park, skate park, and special events area in the northeast quadrant of the site. The next slide that you'll see once again is the refinement of the plans. So this was a point in the project where the EPA provided services from SCIO to help with the reuse characterization, and they put together a project that was once again financed by EPA Region 5. The document built on previous years of reuse framework discussions. It was designed as a screening tool to provide a foundation of fundamental site-specific information and considerations for future uses at the site. It provided 5 site maps, each emphasizing a different aspect of site conditions and highlighting associated issues for consideration in future use deliberations. These 5 maps identified specific details relating to the remedy, utilities, access, drainage, and stormwater, and property parcel ownership. And in 2010, the city used this reuse characterization as an opportunities and constraints document for a site master plan study. What you see on the screen is a master plan that was completed in 2010 as part of the Green Grand Rapids City Master Plan update. We conducted a 2-day design charrette to complete this plan. The design charrette was held at a public facility located close to the former landfill. The format for the charrette was an open house type event. Participants were able to drop in at the charrette location, view the characterization reuse studies, provide ideas and input into the design, and also watch a video showing examples of other Superfund sites that had been opened and improved for recreational purposes. This video really was key, as there were many in the community who were skeptical that this site could actually be reused for something. And so the video was a live example of some other landfill Superfund sites around the United States that had already been converted and reused for recreational purposes. The charrette culminated in a presentation at the end of 2 days, and people were given additional opportunity to comment on the plan. The plan was also reviewed as part of the public comment period for the update of the city's master plan. I know this plan is probably hard to read, so I'll just read off, if you will, a couple of the uses that we proposed for the site, that, once again, that came from suggestions from the community. And that included a special event festival space, skateboard park, multi-age playground, dog park, BMX track, sports fields, archery, restrooms, picnic area with shelter, parks department greenhouses and maintenance building, boat launch, landfill, ecology, interpretive area, farmers market, community gardens, greenhouses, and prairie restoration area. The low-impact development strategies and vision for the site included rain gardens, filter strips, and vegetative swales. You can see on this plan that there were, in fact, some wetlands created on the site, and those can be seen in the upper right-hand corner, shown in blue, and also at a diagonal here in the middle of the left-hand side of your screen. Over the years, the committed city stakeholders used these assessments in the master plan to help bring about recreational reuse at the site. In 2009, access road extensions were used to connect the site to the area's regional network of bike trails. The on-site trail runs from a northern portion of the site through an on-site wetland stormwater retention area. The city and EPA worked together to facilitate use of this access road for running marathons and other events at the site. The boat ramp that was shown on the plan existed, but it was closed during the remediation, and the city's working to put it back in service. The city has applied for and received a grant from the Michigan Department of Natural Resources Waterways Division to complete a preliminary design for parking to support the ramp. The city is working closely with local fishing organizations in that preliminary design. Other recreational opportunities are still under consideration at this site to keep reuse possibilities moving forward. In 2011, Region 5 again helped by us developing a renewable energy assessment to determine if installing a solar energy facility at the site would be feasible. This slide shows the solar reuse assessment. It suggested that approximately 38 acres of the site could be suitable for a solar installation. The report also recommended dedicating 54 acres to recreational and open space along the Grand River and in the northwestern portion of the site. The study was in line with earlier assessments, which had shown that the city and community goals were to preserve these areas for recreational use. If you take a look at the map on your screen, you'll see the green areas were recommended as recreation, and the report indicated the orange areas as potential locations for solar development. This year, the city released a request for proposals for a solar energy generating facility, and the city received 6 proposals, narrowed the field to 3, held interviews with the 3 shortlisted firms, and have chosen a preferred solar provider. Today, we received approval from the City Commission to authorize staff to negotiate a land lease and power purchase agreement with the preferred solar provider. The proposed solar facility will be approximately 20 acres in size, and the energy generated will be transmitted across the Grand River to the city's wastewater treatment plant. And it is estimated that the solar facilities could save the wastewater treatment plant in the range of between $200,000 and $300,000 annually. There remain many opportunities for reuse and also green infrastructure components at the Butterwell landfill. Approximately 30 acres of riparian corridor along the southern edge of the site bordering the Grand River represents green infrastructure opportunities. We're hoping to put the boat ramp back in use as we are undertaking a river restoration project upstream, which will provide whitewater activities for the public.
Thanks, Jay. That's great. And thank you, Tom. Jay, I know you have to go at 3 o'clock, so I'm going to put some questions your way that you and Tom can deal with, I hope. And one is regarding wildlife and the landfill cap. How many feet thick is the cap?
The cap is 4 feet thick. It has 2 feet of compacted clay. It has 18 inches of sand and 6 inches of topsoil.
Okay, and we have another question about that. How will you address tree root growth and animals in the cap? Should they get in there, I guess?
Sure. So far, neither have been a problem. We do have an annual maintenance plan for the site. We actually mow the entire site a certain number of times per year based on the rainfall and weather conditions. As for animals burrowing into the site, we've not had problems with that. The only problems that we've run into is when we've had vehicles, heavy vehicles that have gotten off the paved trails that have rutted the top of the cap, which have then had to be topsoil placed and additional seed put down. But the site is very low maintenance. All the plant or materials that were planted as part of the remediation plan were shallow rooted plants, and so those have been working out quite well.
Okay, and we have some more questions. How was landfill gas venting addressed?
This site generates very little in the way of methane, which is unfortunate because we explored the opportunity for harvesting the methane gas, but unfortunately the amount that it generates is so minimal that we have no need for venting, nor are we able to harvest any of the methane gas that is being produced, which I mentioned was minimal.
That's great. Okay. And we have another question, shifting gears a little bit. In designing ecological elements, to what extent did you use soil amendments to increase water retention? Maybe, Tom, you could help with that.
Yeah, I don't think we did. I would have to talk to Dion a little bit more about it, but I don't think there were used.
Okay.
Yeah, that was my recollection, too, is that there were no soil amendments. So we created the wetland habitats through grading and using the soil on site, and that might have been trucked in.
Okay. And we have a question about cost, where someone is asking,
I'm not sure we'll be able to give you exact dollars, but what is the cost of the solar farm? Is the $300,000 savings after the cost of the farm, the solar farm?
Right. Very good question, and I would have to do some additional research to let you know the cost of the investment by the preferred solar provider. The way we have structured our agreement is that all those costs are borne by the solar developer. The only costs to the city are soft costs related to the city in negotiating a contract with the solar provider. The solar provider builds the facilities. We lease the land to the solar provider. I believe we are looking at a 20 to 40 year lease, at which time the developer is required to remove the solar equipment from the site. Our role is simply entering a power provider agreement and buying the power from the solar provider to help power up our wastewater treatment plant.
Okay, and someone's asked a question about long-term monitoring. So what are your long-term monitoring plans for health impacts, soil, water, and air quality?
We do
have... Jay, I believe those are all part of the remedial project, the long-term monitoring.
Yes.
And I know that you've got a little checklist out there that Dion put together for you to go over the landfill every so often to look at whether there's vegetative concerns and things like that. You guys are doing a good job at filling out that checklist and looking at it periodically.
Yes, thank you, Tom.
And then someone's raising a question, did the solar provider have any issues? Were they concerned about potential CERCLA liability? About being on a cap?
Great question. In our request for proposals, we sought firms who had experience with developing solar facilities on former landfills. And in fact, three of the six responders to our request for proposals had experience developing solar facilities on former landfill sites. And so they came in well-equipped, knowing what the opportunities and constraints would be, and we made it very clear in our request for proposals about needing to work with the cap, not damage the cap, and that any remediation necessary would be their responsibilities as part of construction of their facilities.
Great, thanks. And actually, someone's asked a question, how is the planning and cleanup paid for? So, Tom, you want to answer that with Jay?
Sure. The planning is paid for through the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative program. The cleanup is paid for. I don't know. I have to ask Dion whether I'm not exactly sure who financed the cleanup of the site.
Okay. I think we probably should move on. We will get to the rest of the questions toward the end, but I think at this point I want to thank Michelle and Tom and Jay, and I'm going to turn it over to Carlos Pichon.
Hello. Hello, everybody. Thank you. This is Carlos Pichon here in the same room as Melissa and Michelle. We work in the same office in the Superfund program. And I'm here to give you a short synopsis of the linkages between green remediation and green infrastructure, which I title Green Remediation and Green Infrastructure for a Cleaner and Safer Future. So understanding many of you in the audience may not necessarily come from a remediation background, let me just give you a short intro to that concept. And remediation is, in a sense, a generic term for the work that's needed to clean up contaminated soil and groundwater. And as a nation, we invest literally billions of dollars every year to protect human health and environment from contamination that may have originated historically or from current accidents and activities. Now, cleaning up these sites, contaminated sites, can be considered in and of itself a contribution to sustainable infrastructure. Now, how could that be? Well, mainly really because cleaning up contaminated sites frees them up for reuse, which releases a development pressure on green space. We have some studies that indicate that for every 1 acre of urban land that's made available for reuse, we are freeing up 4 acres of green space that would have to be developed for an equivalent amount of available space because of infrastructure needs, roads, highways, utilities, et cetera. So right there from the beginning, we see that there are certain parallels here between green infrastructure and green remediation. Green infrastructure, one of the concepts, is achieving site development with a lower environmental footprint. A green remediation, on the other hand, is cleaning up contaminated sites with a low environmental footprint. That's one of the first parallels we see. Let's go to the next slide. Thanks, Michelle. Before getting to a little bit more detail on green remediation, I do want to clarify a policy question. And since that tends to be a bit of a burden, addressing policy, I thought I'd bring along some alumnus to help carry the load. So what's the story with the llamas? Well, these two llamas, this picture was taken at Chicago O'Hare Airport. And the reason they're there is that the big open spaces around airports tend to attract wildlife. A lot of burrowing animals that in turn attract foxes and coyotes and birds of prey. And birds of prey and planes, for example, are not a good mix. So airport authorities, therefore, have to address that concern by keeping the grass short, which is less attractive to a lot of that wildlife and makes for a safer environment for airplanes. So the airport authority in O'Hare received a pilot grant, and they put some llamas and some goats and some other herbivores to work in keeping that grass short. So what did we find with that? What is the analogy you want to draw? The analogy is that instead of paving over or using herbicides or using powered equipment to keep the grass short, they used llamas, which avoided that heavier environmental footprint. They achieved that same endpoint with a lower environmental footprint. And that's what we're looking at doing in remediation, getting those sites cleaned up and ready for reuse with a lower environmental footprint. So could we go to the next slide, please? So that basically is our challenge. Our challenge is looking upstream from site reuse, looking at the work necessary to get those sites ready for reuse. And in addition to building sustainability into the reuse concepts, we want to actually get that site ready for reuse and achieve that work with a lower environmental footprint. So a definition we have for green remediation, which, by the way, equates to greener cleanups, green response actions. There are several terms out there for it. And I think greener cleanups is really the one that's taken root, is a practice of considering all the environmental effects of remedy implementation, incorporating options to minimize the environmental footprints of cleanup actions. Okay, let's go to the next slide. But what exactly is an environmental footprint? We've broken it up into a series of core elements, the ones that you have on your screen, to help us use a common language to describe what it is that we're hoping to achieve through these our footprint reduction efforts, and also to better understand where we might focus our footprint reduction efforts. So these five core elements are broken across energy, air, water, land, and ecosystems, and materials and waste. But what does this look like on site? So let me just pick an example on the energy side. Many of the sites we clean up in Superfund and in other programs, often located in remote places where there may not be a utility connection to power systems. Lots of these systems are necessary, for example, to operate pumps, maybe security systems, maybe monitoring systems. And we often find that we have to provide diesel generators or other power sources out there and actually truck in the fuel to keep those guys running. All of that has a significant environmental footprint in energy use, in water, in air emissions, et cetera. And now with the changing technology, technology, we're finding that there are a lot of providers who have either solar or wind power generators that meet the same need of providing power remotely without us having to run those generators or truck that fuel out. So we're able to achieve that same endpoint of powering those remedy systems or those monitoring systems or the security systems, but with a much lower environmental footprint. Another example may be on the water side, water core element. Many of our treatment systems either require large amounts of fresh potable water, or they may generate a lot of water. For example, pump and treat systems, often we have to extract groundwater as part of a containment or treatment of a source area, treat that water and dispose of it. And historically, that water has often gone to publicly owned treatment water facilities. And additionally, some of the operations on the site may have impacts on surface water quality, not unlike any construction site. So what we see here is, for example, an opportunity to use some of that extracted and treated water for on-site operations, such as preparing compounds for treatment compounds, or for irrigation, for dust mitigation, for a lot of on-site activities. We're thereby reducing the use of fresh water while at the same time reusing a resource that's been, in a sense, generated on the site. With respect to the stormwater management on the site, that is an example of how green remediation often borrows best management practices across those five core elements from other sectors of our economy, of our society. Okay, let's go to the next slide, please. But the idea here is that we are adopting and borrowing a lot of those concepts to use them in a phase of a site's life that historically they were not always applied to as extensively as they could. And that is getting the site ready for reuse by cleaning it up. So let's look at two examples that we have here. The first is a site called California Gulch. It's in Leadville, Colorado. The cleanup objectives at this site were to address metals contamination caused by past mine activities on a large 16.5 square mile site. These were to be addressed by minimizing human exposure to heavy metals, minimizing erosion of fluvial mine waste deposits into surface water, which is, in this case, the Upper Arkansas River, controlling leaching and migrating metals, reducing toxins in plants, and reducing exposure of wildlife and livestock to heavy metals in soil and vegetation. Should note, by the way, that this site is located above 10,000 feet, so it has some challenges of its own. The overall green remediation approach at this site was based on minimizing excavation and off-site disposal of contaminated soil through in-situ application of soil amendments. There are a lot of BMPs or core elements addressed there, such as fuel use, transportation, et cetera. They also, by choosing soil amendments consisting of biosolids or agricultural forestry byproducts rather than synthetic products or newly quarried materials to restore soil quality. This, by the way, is one of the questions that one of the participants asked earlier, I think it was Christopher Anderson. In this case, we did look at the use of natural source materials for the remediation, and we've heard earlier that they have also been sourced for the building the green infrastructure. And that's definitely one of the common areas. Looking at these best practices, regardless of whether you're implementing a remediation or whether you are building a green infrastructure. Okay, the another practice was minimizing additional disturbance to the soil profile and salvaging existing vegetation, or integrating remediation processes with restored use of the land for agricultural and recreational purposes and by wildlife. So in the picture, what we see in the top right picture is basically stabilized riverbanks along the Arkansas River, where they use native grass species that can rapidly restore ground cover after remedial activities, and that require little or no future maintenance, such as mowing, irrigation, or fertilizer application, while meeting site reuse needs. What we see there are two rows of sedge and willow that were supported by Benway weirs and now thrive in target areas along the Arkansas River. On the second picture, it's from a site called Elizabeth Mine, a Superfund site in Vermont in EPA's Region 1. And the cleanup objectives here were to restore the Copperas Brook and water resources further downstream that have been negatively impacted by acid rock drainage resulting from runoff passing through waste rock and tailing piles created by historic mining of iron sulfate and copper at this 250-acre site. Both these sites are mining sites. Part of it is coincidence. Part of it is also that a lot of green infrastructure related BMPs are common at this type of site. This site, by the way, there was a very comprehensive green remediation strategy that addressed all five core elements of the of footprint reduction. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I do want to point out that the implementation of this strategy merited the project's receipt of the 2014 Green Dream Team Award under the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Sustainability Award Program. What we see in this the picture here, though, is sediment control through the use of biodegradable seed matting or erosion control fabrics made of agricultural byproducts. Again, an example addressing the question that participant had earlier. This was installed along the soil cap perimeter to control sediment runoff and contain and filter stormwater runoff prior to its gradual subsurface infiltration. So in this case, what we have is a materials and waste core element using recycled materials to address water BMP. But really what I wanted to point out here is that implementing these practices, it doesn't matter if we're, again, building a remedy or implementing a green infrastructure. We're trying to achieve both of those with a lower environmental footprint. Okay, next slide, please. So we started looking at these concepts of greener cleanups and best management practices, et cetera, about more than 5 years ago now. And early on, we identified a challenge of helping project managers in identifying best management practices and having a thought process to select the ones that are most applicable to put in place at a site regardless of the regulatory framework under which you're working, Superfund, brownfields, corrective action, underground storage tanks, et cetera. After a lot of thinking and discussing amongst ourselves and with outside parties, we determined that the best approach was to work with a standards development organization. We finally settled on with ASTM International, and ASTM brought together a large group of stakeholders representing site owners, federal and state regulators, municipalities, construction consulting engineering firms, and others to start working on this standard guide, which after a lot of work was finally released in December of 2013, and it's out there and being used. By the way, the agency stands and supports the implementation of the guide across cleanup programs. There's a policy memo to that effect. And the standard guide, basically what it does, it codifies best practices and defines a process for reducing environmental footprints. It includes over 160 best management practices. It's program neutral, as I said, and it's a very useful protocol for contracting purposes. If you're hiring somebody to clean up a site and you want it done consistent with greener cleanup principles, ask them to have the cleanup implemented consistent with the ESM standard guide, and you'll be a way down the road. So how does it work? Really, basically, when green remediation goals in a cleanup project have been identified by the client, either a contractual requirement, maybe a regulatory requirement, whatever it may be, using the guide, if we have a small cleanup project or standard cleanup approach, like it's just a dig and haul, we can go straight to identifying, basically screening, and identifying applicable best management practices, and then selecting and identifying those that best fit. If we have a larger, more complex site, we may conduct a quantitative footprint, which helps us prioritize our footprint reduction targets across those core elements, and better define the core of the best management practices that get us there. We then select them and implement them. So we have been doing a lot of training on the standard guide. If I could go to the next slide, please. We've had several webinars since its release. We expect to have one in the near future, very well attended. We are also taking training to our project managers within the agency, and we've had training for states in EPA Region 5 and Region 1 just last week. We had Region 7 states around Kansas City. And a lot of those webinars that I've talked about are available on our website, Clune.org/greenremediation. You can find them elsewhere, but this is one URL that has all this information on it. We also have fact sheets for remedy-specific fact sheets on best management practices. It's some of the policies and strategies we've described, including the agency's position with respect to the standard guide, and links to the standard guide itself. So that's about all I want to talk about, the relationships between green remediation and green infrastructure, a couple of examples of how it's put in place, and then a resource that you can use for implementing greener cleanups at a project. And always remember that this is moving upstream a little bit as we're getting ready to implement a remedy. We want to think about how we can implement that remedy with a low environmental footprint before we move on and do the redevelopment using green infrastructure.
Okay, thank you, Carlos. We have a couple of questions for you. Let's see. Someone has written in, have you thought of putting post-remediation requirements into the ASTM guide, like ground cover that doesn't need mowing often and things like that?
That's a good question. One of the big challenges we have was defining a scope around a green remediation analysis. So what types of activities and what is the activity, the temporal, and the spatial boundary of the green remediation, of the application of the standard guide. And there is flexibility in the guide in defining the scope as including activities that are related to the reuse or redevelopment of the site, or both temporal. In other words, it's not just during the operation of the remedy, but after, and also spatial. So we may be concerned about off-site activities if we are directly affecting the footprint through off-site activities. So yes, to answer your question, the standard guide does allow for consideration of spatial and temporal activities beyond the remediation itself, which could include the redevelopment.
Okay, and another question, if you're willing, is someone is wondering whether this is applicable in an urban setting, or is this just for rural areas?
No, this is very applicable in an urban setting, and I pointed out that my two examples were from mining sites, only because of the green infrastructure link. It's easier to make in that case just because of scale. But a lot of urban areas, especially, for example, air quality, the use of what kind of equipment and how we power systems, there are a lot of BMPs that are much more applicable to an urban environment.
Okay. And we also have a question about ecosystem services. What are we doing with that? Are we identifying, are we measuring when we engage in these kinds of activities at sites?
Yeah, good question. Currently, the standard guide when it comes to ecosystem services is based mostly on a qualitative description of what those are and mitigating or reducing impacts on the ecosystem services that are available at the site. Within the Superfund, we're currently looking at a more structured approach to understanding ecosystem services available at a site so that we can better identify how we are impacting those ecosystem services and what BMPs may be available to reduce our impacts on those. So that's a very good question. It's exactly where we are right now, our next step in building the core elements.
Okay, and what would you say generally, I know we're not talking site specifically, but about the cost of using green and biodegradable materials to do remedy work? Would you say we're spending a lot more money or we're saving a lot of money?
Yeah, it's not a comprehensive, statistically significant analysis, but the evidence we have so far is that this is not resulting in cost increases in the implementation of remedies.
Okay, great. And actually, we have a question. Maybe you sent this in, Carlos. If people want to know more, if they want training,
about green infrastructure and green remediation. What would you suggest they do?
Yeah, I didn't do that, but certainly one. I mean, I didn't send the question in. I did provide the link to Cluin.org/green remediation, which is an agency website. Actually, that's the website through which we're having this webinar. So that's the place to go. Now, I certainly identify a lot of opportunities to work with you guys going forward. I think that question a participant asked about implementing some of these practices in building the green infrastructure, there might be great opportunities for us to leverage the work that both programs are doing.
Okay, that's great. I think now we're going to move on to our next speaker, but thank you, Carlos, very much. And I'd like to turn over to Douglas Reed Green.
Hello, everybody. Everybody hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you, but just a real quick time check. We have about 55 minutes left.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead, Douglas.
Okay. Hi, my name is Douglas Reed Green. I work for BASF Corporation, and I'm going to talk to you about the Landia Superfund site and how we integrated green remediation and sustainable development into the program. The Landia site is made up of two parts. The Landia property proper, which was to the east, and a fertilizer manufacturing facility that took up the bulk of the property to the west. Before we get started, I'd like to define what we use, what we at BASF use as our sustainable remediation model, and it goes back to the early discussions about sustainable development. We try to incorporate environmental, ecological, and social benefits into our work, sometimes more successfully than others, but at Landia site, I hope to be able to demonstrate to you that we were able to bring about a truly sustainable end to the project. So when we talk about the different pieces, we'll try to fit them into these three balls. So to begin with, to give you a feel for what we were up against, the site had been used for approximately 50 years in the production of pesticides and fertilizer blends. The soil and groundwater were contaminated with pesticides and nitrates. The soil contamination was a problem because it not only was the environmental impact, but there was also an impact on the local business owner who wished to expand his fertilizer business. It also was an eyesore for the community. If you look at the lower picture, this is what many of the community saw as they drove past the site. And the ecology at the site was consisted of compacted earth, some weeds and concrete, and so did not provide very much ecological benefit. Back in 2007, the group and the EPA agreed upon the cleanup plan, which focused on the direct contact, elimination of direct contact for the pesticides, prevention of migration of the contaminants from the soil into the groundwater, and then in order to accomplish these goals, there's an estimated removal requirement of 25,000 cubic yards of soil. In 2010, EPA asked that volume get extended to the groundwater, so that increased the volume of soil to be addressed significantly. The conceptual site model that was put together for the site showed that there was a significant problem of infiltration causing migration of the contaminants from the soil into both the what we call the water table zone and the basal zone of the aquifer. When BASF joined the group, we started to ask questions about, was there a better plan? Could we do more with the site and get a better result than strictly by removing the 25,000 cubic yards? And we started to look at the concept of bringing using phytoremediation and the green infrastructure concepts to produce a more holistic outcome. So fortunately, we had a receptive EPA team, and working hand-in-hand, the group and our EPA team developed reevaluated the site and determined that there may be a better way to handle the problem. One major component of that was a very significant pre-designed soil investigation program that we put together that truly gave us a very strong picture of the distribution of the contaminants and how they interacted with the site and the ground, the stormwater at the site. It was agreed that we would extend the excavation where practicable to the water table and even below the water table, where we found the highest concentrations of contaminants. We also identified that the particular shape of the site was such that it bowled in exactly the wrong location. Where the majority of the contamination was found was also where the majority of the stormwater infiltrated. So we redesigned the site in order to minimize the infiltration of the stormwater and to develop a site that a capping plan that would then allow us to plant it in a way that was supportive of wildlife and help manage the infiltration. A portion of the site was also capped with an impermeable cap to allow for the fertilizer company's expansion plans. And then we are currently wrapping up some restrictive covenant issues in order to protect the integrity of the cap in the future. So this gives you an idea. Each one of those little pixels, it was a sampling location. Each grid had five samples recovered from it, and the average concentration of those five were used to identify the locations, the concentration of contaminants in those areas, and then we used those to optimize the excavation plan in order to achieve the maximum removal of pesticide mass, and that allowed us to actually reduce the volume of soil that needed to be removed while increasing the mass of pesticides that were taken off the site when compared to the 2007 plan that we were working with. Then the fun part was, on top of that, we were able to then produce a capping system that produced about 5 acres of habitat, at the same time reduced the amount of infiltration in the area. We installed a small amount of impervious cap to allow for business expansion, and a storm water management area with a retention pond that was built into the ecology to provide appropriate stormwater management for the site. Before I get to this slide, let me back up 1 second and tell you that the results that we've seen are such that we had originally had a contingent remedy that would include oxidation injection system. However, the results of the source removal and the stormwater management have been such that we have met the goals for the shallow groundwater, and we are seeing a remarkable recovery of the shallow system at the site, which was the goal of the source of this source removal and capping system. So ecologically, it's been from an environmental standpoint, it's been very successful. We have met the goals of management of direct contact and also impact to the groundwater from the ongoing source. So that part of it's been successful. We've also been able to develop a capping system that over time will mature into a nice Central Florida ecosystem that will bring value back to the community. It supports a variety of wildlife. We are, I believe, we're at 77 different species of birds so far on our little site. We've improved the stormwater management for the area, which allows the fertilizer company to expand its program. And so they're in the process of preparing to almost double their facility and bring jobs into the community. And so in the future, we expect to see a wooded area that will provide a much more attractive green space for the neighbors than the previous vista that they had. So that when we talked to our neighbors who had originally been a vocal force for moving the project forward, they have now become very supportive of the work that's being done at the site, and have been a successful partner with us in getting this project done. So from a sustainable redevelopment standpoint, once again, we've created a habitat that meets the needs of our current business owners, so they can now use it as open space under the local regs to allow them to expand on the property next to to ours. The community has replaced an eyesore with green space. The EPA has and the group have made big strides towards completing what has been a recalcitrant site. Because of the difficult nature of dealing with pesticides, we've managed to, again, manage all the direct contact risks and many of the risks associated with migration to groundwater. We were fortunate enough to receive an award from the EPA for this work, which goes a long way to helping us internally sell similar sites, similar activities within the corporation, because nothing succeeds like success. So if we go back to our original, the model that we talked about at the beginning of my presentation, we talked about the idea of bringing benefit to the environment, and I think we can successfully demonstrate that we've eliminated direct contact risks, managed the source to shallow groundwater, provided an ecological an ecology for wildlife. We have also had social benefits. The community now has a much more pleasant scene that they get greeted with than the old buildings and the facility that was there. And we have the ecological, the economic benefit of the expansion of the local business and the job creation. So it, we do see benefit in all three areas that we have, we were hoping to see. And those, and again, we were very pleased to receive the award for excellence in site reuse from Region 4. And they were kind enough to come down and provide us with recognition and allow the local politicians to gain some benefit from the work that was being done as well. So hopefully that this has led us to, in BSF, to start to look at how to use these same concepts on a broader scale. And we are in the process now of a pilot program where we've selected 8 sites throughout the Atlantic Flyway, where we are going to be bringing the concept of ecological restoration to each of these sites in a way that will be beneficial to the communities in the area, both from an educational and green space. It will provide support for migrating species, both pollinators and birds, and hopefully will be the start of a growing set of natural corridors that BSF is looking at. We are fortunate enough to have most of our sites either along the Atlantic Flyway or the Mississippi Flyway, so we're looking to bring this program to all our sites, both and both those that are undergoing remediation and our active sites. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if there's anything.
This is Melissa. Thank you very much for that presentation. Actually, we do have a question for you that I think you've touched on a little, and people are very interested in what I guess we're calling a sustainability plan in your business model. It
yes.
sounds like you, yeah, yeah, why don't you talk about that a little bit? That'd be great. And have you noticed the difference? Or as somebody said, this really makes a difference in the bottom line.
Yes, well, we've BSF actually was one of the original companies to sign the Global Compact with the UN. We've been, I don't know if it's because of our German parents or just because of some forward-thinking people, but it is part of our culture, sustainability, both from a business, a pure business model, and from a remediation standpoint. We believe that it is critical to what we do, and this happens to be our 150th anniversary, so they must have been doing something okay. But everything we do is put through a sustainable lens, because we believe that it is the only way that we can stay in business is to be part of a sustainable future. Part of that, for me, being a remediation specialist, is to bring more value to the work that we do. And we've found that in doing so, commonly we can get through creative, using green infrastructure, using sustainable remediation, the cost of what we do actually goes down, the value to the environment, both from the remediation and from the redevelopment, increases, and it makes the people working for the company excited, because at the active sites, they get to bring projects forward that get funded and get integrated into our site plans. So we have people, we have one place where we have a camera looking at sturgeon in a river. We have another place where we support several places where we're supporting pollinator plantings. Some of them are small scale, some of them are larger. We are having community gardens that are both on site and in the community themselves. We have a site here in Newark, New Jersey, where we've teamed up with Rutgers and Rutgers University and the local one of the local churches to develop an aquaponics system. So that is integrated with a program we're working on for the remediation of the Passaic River. There's a lot of different ways to look at sustainable issues, but we believe and we are seeing that it is critical to success in our business.
Okay, great. We have another question for you, and then I think we'll do this one, and then we'll move on to our next presenter. But someone has asked, does the fertilizer company still own the portion of the property with the ecological restoration? And if so, does the company pay property taxes on this portion of the property?
They actually they had not owned it, but I don't know if they pay property taxes or if the group's paying the property taxes. There are property taxes being paid on it. But an agreement was made to allow them to use that as part of their site. So their site became inclusive of that area for redevelopment purposes, which allow them to recalculate their impervious surface percentage and allow them for to do more expansion on their part of the property. So it's not been taken out of the tax rolls, but it also supports the redevelopment.
That's great. We actually just had a follow-up question to that, which is, were you able to calculate the volume of stormwater runoff that's now managed by the restored site?
Have not done that, no.
Okay. All right. Great. Sorry. Okay. Thank you very much, Doug. We're going to move on now to Rosemary Caraway. Rosemary?
Hi, everybody. My name is Rosemary Caraway, and I work as a Superfund project manager in EPA Region 9, which covers California, Nevada, Arizona, and some of the other off western area. I'm going to talk to you about the Pemaco Superfund site that's located in Maywood, California. Now, this site is part of our Los Angeles Greenway project, or it became part of or incorporated into the Los Angeles Greenway project, and mainly because the Greenway Project's purpose is to provide recreational amenities in the city of Los Angeles or along the LA River, riverfront. The site, the Pemaco Superfund site, is located in an underserved community, and we were able to incorporate green infrastructure elements to manage both stormwater and the aesthetics of a public park. The other thing that we ended up doing as part of the remedy is also to incorporate both solar panels into the remedy, and then also we did thermal heating as part of our remedy. So I'm going to go ahead and see if I can move forward to the next slide. Okay, so can you move the slide for me, because when I'm doing it, it's not working. Thank you. So the Pemaco site is in Maywood, California. It's a 4-acre tract of land along the Los Angeles River. It directly abuts the LA River. And so what you're seeing here is a site probably about in the 1950s, if you will. Next slide, please. It's a custom blending facility in the city of Maywood. It operated from the 1940s till 1991. In 1993, we were actually asked to look at the site because the fire destroyed the warehouse in 1993. In general, the site carried or had 31 underground storage tanks. It had 6 above-ground storage tanks and over 400 drums on site. The EPA investigation detected hazardous chemicals, including chlorinated solvents, aromatic solvents, petroleum, hydrocarbons, and flammable liquids present in the soil. And then we had 1,4-dioxane present. In general, the volatile organic compound, we had emissions from in both the soil and the groundwater. And this picture shows the former warehouse building after the fire. Another reason why it came to EPA attention was because there were children playing on the site, and so a city official actually ended up calling our emergency response team. Next slide. In 1997, we did removal. So we implemented measures to stabilize the site. So we raised all of the infrastructure, which you see on the left, and then we removed the remaining storage tanks, which you see on the right. This is actually one of my most favorite pictures of the site because it shows just how large those tanks were. We installed a soil vapor extraction system and treated about 144,000 pounds of soil via soil vapor. We expanded the EPA site assessment, and then that resulted in the site being listed to the national priority list. Our final remedy for the site was selected in 2005, and it included lots of community outreach and a public comment period. Actually, the public comment period was extended for a fairly long time, probably about four or five months, just to accommodate all the questions and concerns that were being raised by people in the community. The next slide, please. So this conceptual site design, if you will, is a design of the park. The City of Maywood and the Trust for Public Land had started talking about implementing the park within the City of Maywood. And the discussions were to revitalize the industrial lands along that LA riverfront into the community. In general, there were about 6 acres of land, eight properties that were in this particular area. So if you're looking at from Alamo Avenue up towards the river, there were a number of industrial properties. If you look across the street from 59th Place, those are residential housing. So we have, and what we had in the city was residential lands, and directly across the street, a normal kind of neighborhood environment, if you will, was industrial lands. And so the purpose was to actually turn some of those industrial lands into recreational use. So EPA worked with the City of Maywood, the Trust for Public Land, California State Coastal Conservancy, California State Water Resources Control Board, as well as local and elected officials between 1998 and 2005 to look at planned uses for the site. The future site was definitely going to be recreational reuse, and that was considered in all of our EPA activities. And that's while we were doing the remedial investigation, while we were doing sampling, while we were doing risk assessment, remedial design and construction. We even had our risk assessor look at the EIR plan for the site as it was being developed by the City of Maywood. So EPA staff and contractors work together to come up with a conceptual design. So they did their design. I'd have our technical staff look at it and see if there were issues or concerns that we might have about the design, and then we would discuss those in meetings that we had with the city and some of the planners associated with recreational use. So let's see. Thank you. Construction of the remedy began in August of 2005 and included the installation of the underground extraction wells, vapor extraction wells, and underground piping that would transport both the groundwater and the vapor to the treatment plant. So what you see here is one of our trenches for the contaminated vapor back to the treatment plant. And the treatment plant hasn't been built yet, but it's going to be close across the street from that orange and white building that you see in the background of that photo. And so these photos are from the eastern trench. 10,000 feet of pipe was laid in the trenches from the site to the treatment plant. So next slide. So here you see the trench network was then covered. with a liner and a one-foot soil cover, which is about 17,000 yards of soil. I think if I was going to, one of the things that might be a little bit different here is the consideration of where to place the treatment plant. So we're placing the treatment plant. In this case, the decision was made to place it at the end of the of the park, or where the boundaries of the park would be, instead of right in the middle of the park. So if we had placed it where the plant was located originally, it would have been smack in the middle of the park. So that there was a decision made to actually move it, so it was on the edges of the of the parkland. So next slide. We completed the construction of the treatment plant in early December 2006. We adjusted the placement of the groundwater plant to best accommodate the park. 2007 investigations confirmed that the subsurface contamination from the site was not impacting indoor air quality of the home. So one of the things we did during the RI process was to actually sample indoor air and ambient air in the neighborhood surrounding surrounding the site. So we kind of knew what the issue was, and it's LA. So what we determined was that the outdoor air quality was actually worse than what we were getting indoor, and it just showed up in the in the sampling as we did indoor air. In general, one of the other things that we talked about at the site was actually installing solar panels. So the I think it's really important to just point out that when this particular plant was developed, we were at the beginning of consideration for both for looking at green on Superfund sites. So for us, we looked at the solar panels. They were installed in July of 2007. In general, they produce it's a 3.4 kilowatt solar system at the treatment plant. It's probably equivalent to what you would see on some of your homes, so it's not set up as this large solar array, if you will. But in general, because of what we're doing there, we were offsetting about 3.3 tons of carbon dioxide per year, and we saved about 2.5 acre trees and 7,600 car miles. So I think the purpose was to actually show that we could utilize it, that we could utilize it as an assistance to the treatment plant, but it wasn't what we see now in terms of solar panels actually being fully utilized and having more space or more solar panels. Next slide. So we're looking at, here we're looking at the Maywood Riverfront Park as it's being developed or further along. So in an earlier slide, I showed you all the dirt where we were kind of putting down the cap cover, if you will. And so what you see here in the picture is the guys are working on the actual implementation of some of the infrastructure for the park. In general, I think what's important is because we were meeting consistently meeting with both city officials and then coordinating meetings where if I was meeting with contractors, then we would meet with the city designers, is that we came up with a decision to actually start the construction of the remedy in the park at the same time. So in the image on the left, you see that infrastructure, and then in the right, you see kind of our gate to the LA River. So this particular gate on one side of it, you see the park, or you're looking into the park, and this is out on the, actually the LA, the picture is being taken from the LA walkway, if you will, or the LA River walkway. So the park offers a number of amenities to residents, soccer fields, playground equipment, handball courts, basketball courts, and the Los Angeles River bike path. So the bike path actually goes alongside the river from various cities. It's only, at the time that this was built, there was only one park in the city of Maywood. It became the second park, and since 2008, when we've opened it, they've opened a couple of smaller parks since then. So this is kind of the impetus to really, really help with the needs within the community to actually have more green space. So it's become integral to the life of the residents living in the area. It's in constant use. And the city of Maywood is moving forward to actually continue to buy land. The other thing that happened is after this was built is the soccer fields turn out to be extremely well used. So there's a need for more soccer fields, and the handball court was put in after the fact also. So and then there's still more land left to the park for the redevelopment. But unfortunately, the city got caught up in the state of California when we took away the redevelopment agencies. So there's still more parts of the land that need to be redeveloped, and I think they're just working on trying to figure out how they're going to fund it now that they've lost the redevelopment monies. Next slide, please. So I thought I'd just show you a couple of pictures of some of the park, just to get you to just give you some of the images for the city. So on the left, you see the kids, in the middle of the picture, you see the kids' playground. On the right, you see kind of a walkway. To the left of that green bush is actually where they actually built some handball courts for residents. If you go to the next one, next slide. We have picnic pavilions and walking paths. So there's pathways through the park. In general, what we're seeing in terms of use is lots of families utilizing the park, specifically on the weekends. During the summer months, there's a lot of use also because the kids are home. You also see a lot of use where there's discussion. How do I put this? Discussion or argument between kids and, quote, older kids over the use of the soccer fields. And some of those older kids actually happen to be adults. Next slide, please. Again, basketball courts to the right, and then this one shows a couple of views again of the pathway that was within the park. Next slide. And so there's a fence around the park itself. If you look at the image on the left, this time you're inside the park looking out at the LA River. The LA River, just for folks who don't know, is actually a concrete channel in this part of the city. So there's, when you walk through that gate, you're on a pathway that you can ride the bike along, and then the drop off is the LA River channel, if you will. The image on the right actually shows the bike path itself, and I guess this is showing that we've gotten a lot more growth on that in that park over time. Now, next slide, one of the things I just kind of showed you the broader amenities of the park. We want to point out some of the green infrastructure features. They've just been integrated into the park. They're naturally direct and clean stormwater to prevent erosion and reduce the need for more expensive gray infrastructure elements. So that was actually built into the park design. The image on your screen is from 2006, and that's in the beginning before the planning was more established. So a lot of those trees that you see there in that picture that are looking like sticks are very healthy tree growth over the last since 2006 when we opened the park. So next slide. Again, we'll have landscape berms. So on the other side of that tree is a berm, and that's a break between your open space and then you're slowly going overland and capturing some of the stormwater into directed channels. And so these berms direct the water away from the picnic pavilions, but also provides kind of a sense of privacy while you're inside the park. I when I was talking to folks about giving this talk, one of the things I discussed was that for this particular site, a lot of what we were doing is stuff that would happen if you were designing the park itself. The monies for the design of the park, though, just to clarify that, were separate funding. So the actual construction of the park, implementation of the green infrastructure and so forth was paid for by redevelopment monies through those other organizations in addition to the city of Maywood. But the discussion in terms of maybe where park, where pathways were, was kind of in line with EPA because we actually have within some of that green space and maybe even along some of those pathways, we actually have underground, we have groundwater wells. So there are groundwater wells within the park, and when we're sampling, we're actually sampling sometimes. We're spending at least a day or two in the park when we're doing some of our sampling. Next slide. So here again, bioswells. So the stormwater, again, is directed by the berms into these vegetative bioswells. That slows the water transport and then reduces the potential for erosion. I think one of the things that we're seeing is the growth here in the park has been really, really well maintained, and the vegetation has grown a lot over time. So the only issue that they have, I think, in terms of if you're looking at it as an inner city park and you're thinking about building, is if you're going to do soccer fields, it's trying to figure out a way to make sure you have you can handle heavy use. So the soccer fields themselves sometimes maintain green, and then sometimes they don't because they're being so heavily used. So there are times when the city has to actually close them so they can allow some grass to grow on the land. So next slide. So if I was going to look at this from a green infrastructure summary, and I looked at some of the things that we talked about earlier in terms of improved stormwater, increased recreational activities, and revitalize the site ecology. For us, we looked at the improving the stormwater. So we have stormwater kind of retention built into the system, but mainly also through landscape berms and the bioswells. In terms of increasing the recreational amenities, we have trails and greenways. So you have the park connected to the overall county greenway so that people can ride their bikes along that trailway. If they want to stop and rest, they can come into the park and sit on one of the pavilions. Some of the areas in the pavilions, people are actually cooking, so there's also the ability to actually utilize cooking food, but anyway, they're able to cook in the park, if you will. In addition to that, the spaces themselves include athletic, the field or the ability for the kids to play soccer, and then we have the handball courts, and then we're restoring the community's connection to their urban waters. And we would say urban waters. I would say that for them, it's the ability to walk outside your door, especially the homes across the street, and then actually be in a park environment. So one of the things that I guess we didn't talk a little bit about is watching the neighborhood change as the park was being developed. So you saw redevelopment also in some of the homes across the street as people tried to make the homes just a little bit more aesthetic or just improve the quality of the homes because now they had a park across the street. So I saw there were times when we were right after the build where you saw a lot of redevelopment, or I saw a lot of redevelopment some of the actual home structures. So next slide. So if you have any more questions, you can talk to me or Gary or Rusty from the Pemico point of view. I think what I do want to mention, though, is that in terms of looking at green infrastructure, we implemented green infrastructure here, but we also, in terms of our remedy, we also used electrical resistive heating. So we actually, the vapors and groundwater that were collected and bought into the treatment plant, we used a thermal oxidizer on the site to actually clean them up. And then for the most contaminated soils, we did in-place thermal heating at the site. So that land has actually become available to the city as of the beginning of this year. We removed all the infrastructure, I think November, December of 2014, going into this year. So now for the city of Maywood, there's a part of the park that's not developed yet. And so as soon as they got redevelopment money, they probably will move ahead with trying to implement the rest of the park development. So I think I'm done.
Okay, Rosemary, thank you so much. We have a number of questions. So the first one is, where do the berms, channels, and bioswales direct stormwater runoff to? Is most of the stormwater infiltrated into underlying soil, or is stormwater primarily directed to a
receiving water body or to the gray sewer system?
It's mostly into the swales themselves and then into the sewer systems,
Okay, and we actually have a couple of questions on stormwater, so let me try another one.
Okay.
Let's see. Okay, is the stormwater runoff from the roadways and parking areas treated in the bioretention areas?
No, they're totally separate. What the city did was they redesigned that street. That street used to be a two-way street, so it'll accommodate the parking because we're still in an inner-city environment. So this is an inner-city urban environment. They turned the streets into a one-way development. So it was more, I think, controlling of stormwater on the land as you're developing it, and then directing it to some of the street stormwater issues, and then providing areas so that water can still infiltrate, but not cause flooding on the land.
Okay, and we've got some more. So what measures were taken to reduce stormwater infiltration to contaminated soil, or was this not a consideration since groundwater is treated?
In general, we removed surface soil to contaminated soil in some areas on the land before the construction started. There was contamination within the 30-foot zone on the former Pemico properties, and so for that, it's the soil vapor extraction system. So there are wells located there that can actually pull vapor and pull water and send it back to the treatment plant.
Okay.
And then on the most heavily contaminated area, we did thermal heating, which I didn't show in any of these slides.
Okay.
So if we go back to the slide. I think the conceptual design slide, I think it's like three or four. Sorry, page five, yeah, that one. So if you look at 59th Place, construction of the park is from 59th Place north, and then where the circle is, So where the circle is, if you move to where the red circle is, at the where the V is, it's undeveloped from there downwards towards 60th Street. So everything north is developed. Yeah, so from there downward is not developed yet.
Okay, and I guess a number of people have written in saying now that there's kind of a drought in California that we're all hearing about, has that changed a lot at the park?
It's probably not helping the city keep the soccer fields from remaining dirt with a little bit of grass. I mean, in that sense, they are trying to water the area. So I am not sure how Jerry Brown, I think, did a new requirement for those of us handling water in the last couple of months. I'm not sure yet how it's going to impact the riverfront park.
Okay.
At one point, we did consider giving them the water, but it just didn't work out. Our water, but it just didn't work out.
All right, I'm gonna just stop for a second because we still have to get through a few more things. But Rosemary, thank you for your in-depth stories about how green infrastructure strategies have been employed at Superfund sites, and we found that throughout SRI's history, sharing stories of successful reuse projects is one of the most effective tools for promoting reuse. So these stories highlight effective tools and resources, and they provide inspiration, I think, for those looking to reuse contaminated properties. And our presenters have done this today by sharing their stories, and we very much appreciate it. So I'd like to wrap up our time by just providing you with some resources. I'd like you all to take a survey, and if we still have time, we can do our extended question and answer period. So just to get through everything very quickly, SRI has a number of tools and resources on our website, and I'd encourage you to check out the sustainability section, which provides specific information on incorporating sustainability tools and approaches, including green infrastructure, into Superfund redevelopment. So if you would take a look at that, and then
on my next slide, every region has an SRI redevelopment coordinator to support reuse at the site-specific level. So if you'd like more information about an existing reuse project or you'd like to discuss exploring reuse opportunities for a site near you, feel free to reach out to your regional coordinator. We have the contact information listed on your screen, but another way to access this is by clicking on the SRI coordinator's link in your resources tab to the right of your screen. Okay. Next slide. Great. If you have any general questions about the material covered or you'd like more information, don't hesitate to contact me or Frank Avisado and visit the website. And what I'd like to do is ask Jean to switch the slide view to the survey screen, and I really want to encourage you all to fill it out. We use your feedback when we consider future webinar topics, so feel free to let us know what topics you'd like to see. And in fact, this webinar is a result of people saying we'd really like to see a webinar on green infrastructure. And if you'd please add your email address at the bottom left if you'd like to be on our notification list for future webinars. Okay. So while we're doing that, I guess we could take a few more questions. Let's see. Okay, I hope you all are filling out the all right, great. Okay, we do have, Rosemary, if you're still there, we do have a question. Someone has asked that maybe building a park is not a traditional redevelopment. Did you, was it hard for you to explain to people that this is what you wanted to do and that you weren't building a store or you weren't doing some kind of economic redevelopment? Did that enter into your discussions?
No, I think for us it was more community members coming or community and the Trust for Public Land coming to us and saying that's what they wanted to do. I think where it became, I had to be cautious as a project manager is to make sure that the funds being spent by EPA were towards cleanup. And so we'd have to have meetings about that and have discussions about, well, this part of it is cleanup, and then this part is your responsibility because it's the park. And just had to be very cautious and when implementing it so that you kept everything separate. But that required just us having meetings and everybody just being open about what their needs were.
That's great. Okay, I have time for one more question, which someone's asking about native plants. Were they used exclusively in the park design?
I'm sorry. As much as I plant, I did not pay attention to that. I think they were. I remember us having a discussion about it, but I'd have to honestly look that up.
Okay. All right. I think we're running out of time, which is really amazing, and I really appreciate everyone's participation. I want to thank you all for your questions and for joining us, and I especially want to thank our presenters. And I think I'll turn it back over to you to wrap up.
Yeah, I think, Jean, I think we're ready to wrap up today's session with some closing slides from you. Oh, yeah, and just a reminder, that Superfund Redevelopment Initiative is part of a series. It's ongoing, and our next one is scheduled for August 13th from 2 to 4 p.m., we're going to talk about potentially responsible party perspectives on Superfund site reuse. And also, all of the webinars that we have delivered in this series are archived and available at cluin.org/SRI. So I encourage you to check those out if you want to learn about some other Superfund redevelopment initiative topics. With that, Jean, I think maybe I'll turn it over to you to let folks know how they can provide us with some feedback and get more information on Cluin webinars.
All right. Thank you so very much. So in the last moment that I have with everyone, I just want to remind remind everyone that all of the presentation materials can be found on the resources or links page. That URL is active from this point forward, so if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying today's archive, you can follow the link under the related URLs to seminar resources, or you can just simply click on the link I shared in the question box in the lower right corner. Either one will send you to the area where you can download copies of the presentation materials. We would ask if each of you could take just a brief moment and fill our short online feedback form out for us. We do continue to read each and every one of your responses, and we depend on your feedback to help us continue these free online internet seminars through the Cleanup Information Network. One key thing, if you shared the line with multiple people, if you follow the link to the seminar feedback form that's available from the homepage or, again, under the related URLs window, you might need to scroll down to the bottom to find the link to the feedback form. But if you fill that form out, there's two things I'll point out. Number one, you can fill that form out multiple times. So when you fill the form out, there will be a link that appears to let someone else hop on the computer and fill out the form themselves. So if you happen to be sharing the line with multiple people, you can each take a turn and fill out your own feedback form. You don't have to share common feedback. You can each give us your opinion. You can also fill this form out tomorrow or later on today. Again, that link will be active from this point forward. Also, a number of participants use our seminars through CLUIN for CEUs, PDHs, or formal training requirements. While we don't necessarily issue CEUs or PDHs, we do have methods for you to document your participation, which you might be able to use to still earn credit for today's session. So if you fill out that online feedback form, you'll notice there should be a box that appears on that feedback form. I've circled it in red. As long as you check that box and you've correctly entered your own contact information in there, when you submit feedback, you should receive an automated confirmation email that you can save, which will verify that you shared feedback after the live delivery. Usually, if you have copies of the presentation materials and or your registration emails or these confirmation emails for sharing feedback, that's enough to verify that you participated in the live event or replayed the entire recording event. As I mentioned earlier, today's entire session was recorded, and we will make that archive available in approximately 1 to 2 business days. Everyone who signed up for today's event, including those of you who are stuck on the wait list, will receive a link to replay that recorded version of today's session, and you're certainly welcome to share that with others who will find it valuable uses of their time. I want to thank the nearly 420 individuals who joined us from actually all over the world for today's live broadcast, and all of our presenters and organizers who helped make today's session happen. So again, thank you so very much for joining us. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.